Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The Wisconsin Supreme Court will soon decide whether to accept the legal challenge by Republican lawmakers to Governor Tony Evers' order that extends Safer at Home until May 26th. Evers lays out specific criteria, his Badger bounce-back plan that could lead to reopening some businesses. But protesters and WMC's president say the governor must do more to reopen Wisconsin for business.
We've got to make sure that we're getting back to work, but we're doing so as safely as we possibly can.
And the Supreme Court weighs whether to rein in the broad partial veto power over spending bills that governors have exercised for decades. That and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 24.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Rewind for this week, J.R., as you predicted last week, lawsuit filed by the state two Assembly Republican leaders, Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald and Assembly Speaker Voss. Let's just go through the elements of what they are alleging. We can talk about that a little bit. Republican leaders asked the Supreme Court to rule bypassing circuit courts and the Court of Appeals. That suit alleges the governors illegally extended Safer at Home until May 26, giving czar-like, that's a term from the lawsuit that you and I read, powers to unconfirmed Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm. Allegation, Safer at Home could be repeatedly extended until Wisconsin's economy is, Republican term, shambles. The order denied the legislature its constitutional duty to oversee state agency rules. The injunction should be issued to block arbitrary and capricious order. As the Supreme Court gave the Evers administration until Saturday, Tuesday to respond. JR, give me your thoughts on the lawsuit and its allegations.
A couple of things in there. One, the suit is trying to force the U.S. administration to begin what's called the emergency rules process. That's basically a process where the administration creates a rule, and then the legislature has oversight of that rule. In fact, if you read the lawsuit closely, what it says is that it wants the injunction preventing enforcement of the second stay-at-home order, but it wants to stay that injunction by 6 days so that the Evers administration could begin working on this emergency rule. At the same time, the suit argues that Evers folks should be doing that rule right now in preparation for a successful ruling from a conservative-dominated court. Same day the suit was filed, Voss and Fitzgerald sent a letter to DHS Secretary Palm saying basically, you should be working with us now on this emergency rule because you're going to lose in court. And that's something to watch, is that they want oversight. Now, with the deadlines we have laid out from the court, the Tuesday response from the Evers folks, I think the 29th, if you are not a party to the suit, you can file a friend of the court brief. The 30th, Republicans have to respond to the Evers filing. From there, the question is, how quickly will the court rule on this request? In theory, we could get halfway through the second stay-at-home order before we see a ruling from the Supreme Court, if not farther. So I'm not sure how much of an impact the ruling will have because of the timing. Flip side, if the court issues something like right away, yes. Now we're talking like, okay, what's going to happen next? And how are two sides who have not had a good relationship to date, they had a brief detente during this whole COVID-19 thing, but have broken back down where they were before. How those two sides work together on something of this magnitude in light of what's going on?
Okay, now, JR, as we've repeatedly said, you and I are not lawyers, but it looks to me like there's three decisions the court has to make. Number one, take the case or send it back to lower courts. Number two, enjoin. And if there is an injunction issued, that's a pretty good sign that Evers administration's got to go back to the drawing board on this thing. And the immediate, number three, would be the immediate response of the Evers administration in terms of drafting a different reopening plan. And we're going to spend a lot of time on this show talking about reopening plans. But immediately, don't you agree? Shall we take the case? Shall we send it back? And shall we enjoin?
Yeah, and then that third piece, that six-day window, will the court agree to that or something longer or even shorter that says, okay, you've got some time to try and work on something now? Again, we're not lawyers, but administrative rules process can be cumbersome and take a long time. 6 days is not exactly what I usually see for a rule being promulgated and approved. However, you know, there's that question, will the Evers folks be working on something as a backup? You know, we'll see.
Okay, okay. And now let's take a look at what the players here said. And first, let's quote from the Senator Fitzgerald and Assembly Robin Voss defending this lawsuit. The governor has denied the people a voice through this unprecedented administrative overreach. That leaves the legislature no choice but to ask the Supreme Court to rein in this obvious abuse of power. Wisconsinites deserve certainty, transparency, and a plan to end the constant stream of executive orders that are eroding both the economy and their liberty. And we're going to look at two Governor Evers' responses. First, earlier in the week when he was asked, the lawsuit, quoting the governor, tells Wisconsin residents their health doesn't count. Legislative Republicans, frankly, have said to the people of Wisconsin, our power, our political power is more important than your health. The more we screw around with it, people are going to die. And now, yesterday, taking questions, the governor was asked again about the lawsuit, and he specifically referred to Speaker Voss. So let's hear the governor's comments yesterday.
I have, on occasion, talked to Speaker Voss about this issue, but the fact of the matter is, I haven't seen the Republicans come to the, you know, took them a month or 3 weeks, several weeks before they had their plan to bring to the legislature. He and the legislative Republicans have decided to take this to the Supreme Court. And that's nothing more than a blanket, obvious power grab, which I reject. We hope that the state Supreme Court hears our argument, which I think will be prevailing. And we can move forward. Going back and forth with but Robin Voss at this point in time is not necessarily helpful.
Any PS on the back and forth on the statements made by our three top elected officials, JR?
Other than that, it's back to where we were, kind of square one with these guys in a relationship. It was interesting to watch for a while. Okay, would they work together through this process? And it looked like for a couple of weeks. Remember the first stay-at-home order. Republicans did not criticize the order. They were critical of how it was rolled out, but they were somewhat quiet about any issues they had. Now we're back to where we were before, where it is kind of, you know, a political power struggle at times between the governor and lawmakers, and they are not on the same page, which is where they've been basically the entire time Evers has been in office.
Right. Okay, new topic. The governor did roll out what he called the Badger Bounce Back Plan, and it, let's preface it. I mean, let's break it down into two categories, if and then. Number one, the governor, Evers, says if 85,000 can be tested weekly for COVID-19, the number of positive tests statewide falls for 14 days, there's more personal protective equipment available, and hundreds, I've heard one figure, 1,000 more contact tracers are added statewide. Now, before we get into the if, the then part of the if then, let's hear from Secretary Palm in terms of just about the dramatic increase in the number of tests, please.
We are doubling down on the Badger Bounce Back Plan to test every Wisconsin resident who needs a test, to trace every positive case and their contacts, and to track the spread of the virus. We set this goal of 85,000 tests a week, which is about 12,000 tests a day. Today, we are, I think, just over 10,000. We will be better informed about whether 85,000 a week is enough as we understand more closely the prevalence of the disease in this state. We will continue to expand our capacity, likely well beyond 85 if we're able, but that is not a rate-limiting factor as we think about turning the dial on Safer at Home.
Okay, just to finish that, JR, I'll give you a chance in a minute. Thanks for your patience. We've heard the ifs. Now about the then, here's what the governor says. Phase one, restaurants and retailers could reopen with safety practices, gatherings up to 10, okay. Phase two, bars, non-essential businesses can reopen with safety precautions, gatherings up to 50, okay. Phase three, social distancing requirement and limits on mass gatherings, would be eliminated. Schools and daycare centers can return to March operations. Thanks for your patience, JR. Does this parallel kind of what the Trump administration had laid out in terms of rolling reopening?
Well, this is what the Evers folks try to couch it as. That this is basically what the feds are recommending. Our Republican lawmakers push back, saying there are more restrictive things here, like the testing benchmark, that's a much higher bar than what's in the federal guidelines. One thing I heard from several people this week was that if the governor had paired this plan with the announcement of the second stay-at-home order, it would have saved him a lot of grief. Because remember, there was like this kind of pushback right away about the second order, like, okay, what's the timeline? What's the plan? At some point, we have to go back to some sense of there's light in the tunnel. So if he had put this out last week, it would have helped him politically. Same time, now there's a pullout this week, Protect Our Care paid for it. It's a Dem group. It's from a Dem firm, public policy polling. A plurality of people say that voters in Wisconsin say that Governor Evers is properly balancing the needs of Wisconsinites' health with the needs of the economy. So still getting decent marks there, above water on his handling of COVID-19 in general. Much more trusted than President Trump, whose numbers weren't very great in that poll. Again, it's one poll. That's our first look at like how people are reacting post second stay-at-home order, along with this plan being rolled out of how to reopen the state.
Right. Okay. And now let's look at, as you alluded to, some of the pushback, some of the responses. Now let's specifically talk about that. Last weekend, a Brookfield rally, in just a few hours, protesters wanting Wisconsin reopen for business will be massing here on the Capitol, just a few steps from where we are. And you had two conservative senators, Dave Craig and Steve Noss, saying the Senate should meet to dismiss, which means not confirm, DHS Secretary Palm. And you had the Racine and Dodge County sheriffs, and now, as I read your reporting, some others are questioning, some are harsher than others, on the extension of the Safer at Home order. JR, before we get into the WMC and the capping of plan, let's hear. I interviewed Kurt Bauer, president and CEO of WMC, and here's what he said about their concern about the way the governor extended Safer at Home. Please.
We're looking at nearly 400,000 Wisconsinites have now filed for unemployment insurance benefits since March 25th. We're looking at in excess of 16% unemployment in Wisconsin. In fact, it was 16% a week ago, so it's probably closer to 17% now. The highest we've ever recorded in Wisconsin history is 13% in 1982, and the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development projects unemployment to go as high as 27%. My guess is that it'll probably go longer if we continue this safer at home. The bottom line is that we recognize that the governor has to protect lives. We understand that completely, but remember, when the governor originally announced a safer from home, he said the reason, the justification, was that we didn't want to overtax our hospitals, and particularly in the areas where the COVID-19 virus was hitting the hardest, mainly in Milwaukee, also in Dane County. And we have achieved that. And now we should begin the process of planning for an incremental, smart, safe approach to getting Wisconsin back to work. And we recognize that not all parts of the state are the same. We know that we have outbreaks in certain parts and we have relatively little outbreaks of other parts of the state. And we also know that different sectors of the economy represent a different risk profile. So what we're looking at is something that is based on risk assessment for both region and for sector. Manufacturing, office environment have a different risk profile than, say, a bar or an entertainment venue. So we need to factor all of that in. And what we want to do is work with the sector-specific trade associations who know their industry the best to come up with a plan that can safely get their employees back to work. Because we do recognize we've got to protect the public, obviously, but you know that first step of doing that is making sure that we protect our workers so that they feel comfortable and safe going back to work.
JR, when I interviewed Kurt Bauer, WMC had not put forth any stage plan to reopen Wisconsin. You've done a lot of work on some of these emerging plans to reopen Wisconsin. So can you update us on that and the new plan from State Senator Kapinga?
Yeah, so WMC put out its plan today. It basically wants to create a formula where you take into account factors such as the infection rate in your county, population density, what kind of business you're in, and like, i.e. how much personal contact there is in your business. And then you plug all these numbers into a formula. This is okay, you can open at this date. You have to do these things to stay open and that kind of thing. It's one of several plans we've seen now. This was worked on with Kapinga, Republican from Delafield, who had a little bit different version earlier in the week that we saw. So there's that piece is out there. Cody Horlocker, a Republican from Kiwanago, he led two dozen semi-Republicans with a proposal that would basically do a a 4-week rollout, and you would first open up outdoor activities, right? Even like patios for bars and restaurants, allow service out there, open up the outdoors, and you'd go week by week. The hitch would be if you saw an uptick in deaths from 1 week to the next, you would pause, not go the next step. It'd also be a little more of a regional approach. We've also seen the Tavern League, for example, put out its own idea of how bars and restaurants should be able to start opening again with social distancing in effect, those kinds of things. What we're waiting for is Governor Evers to see if he's going to embrace any of these ideas or if he's sticking to his plan, which is, again, this benchmark of testing, capacity for avoiding any crisis care for people, basically that hospitals can handle the workload of those who have COVID-19 without any stress, essentially. That's his plan. Will he embrace these alternatives, or will he be forced to embrace them because the state's a pre-court decision? So we're kind of watching that at this point to see any changes in what he's trying to do.
Okay, well, let's ask this question. If the Supreme Court enjoined the extension of Safer at Home until May 26, wouldn't that then invite these leaders, the Kappingers and the Bowers and members of the Evers administration to really come in and do some serious negotiating on phasing in some of these reopening of businesses?
It could force it. And some of the feedback I got this week was that the governor is kind of unique in that he's not a very political person. It's kind of like his appeal, but also sounds a weakness. Whereas a Scott Walker or Jim Doyle kind of built up these networks over years. They had these big circles of people they talked to. The view is that Evers has a much smaller circle of people he consults with when he makes big decisions. What I'm getting at is if he had taken the time, some people argue, to talk to a wider circle of people, it maybe had would have shaped the view that he had in coming out with his plan, which got some pushback. Now, the governor's plan might be the best one out there. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a doctor or scientist. But what I'm getting at is that sometimes in politics, it helps you to have a large circle, a large network to bounce things off of, to get their feedback and get their buy-in. So when you put something out, they're singing your praises or they're singing the benefits of your plan as it's out there in the public view.
So potentially a Supreme Court injunction could force some of these groups to begin talking about phased reopenings, correct, bottom line?
And how does the governor, how does it handle the negotiations and the leadership? Because we have not seen them successfully work together on very many things so far this term. I mean, even the bill that passed on a bipartisan basis a couple weeks ago, it was hashed out in some part by the four legislative leaders with input from Evers, but it was not necessarily driven by the governor from what people told me.
Okay, yeah, okay.
It was a foundation of it, but yeah. In those talks, it seemed like at times it was the four leaders working out more than was the governor.
Okay. Okay, the first Safer at Home order is due to expire very soon. So I wanted to take a one-month look back from March 23rd to April 23rd, which is yesterday, because we're not going to get new DHS figures until 2 o'clock this afternoon. So I just want to document what the numbers show from the Department of Health Services. Let's look at those. On March 23rd, the number of positive cases statewide, 457. Number of deaths, 5. Fast forward 1 month, April 23rd, number of positive cases, 5,052. Number of deaths, 257. And I'm so intrigued. The counties with the most positives, Milwaukee, 2,382, 150 deaths. Brown, 455 with 2 deaths. Dane, 387, 21 deaths. Kenosha, 294, 6 deaths. Waukesha, 280, 14 deaths. And DHS notes that 33%, one-third, of those who tragically died from COVID-19 are African Americans. Stats like these, JR, what impact do you see them having going forward on the dialogue?
Well, look at the hot spots. So Brown County's on that list in part because it had a breakout at a company up that neck of the woods. So if you're trying to reopen the economy or pushing for a quicker pace, it seems to undercut the argument a little bit when you have these breakouts at various facilities. So how do you address that? I get the impression it's part of why WMC is looking at this kind of formula that would help mitigate risk in their minds, but I just don't know how it's going to help momentum to move things faster than the governor wants to if you keep having outbreaks like this in various places.
Well, and it numbers like this, fuel the regional debate, that northern Wisconsin doesn't have these numbers, that really the high numbers are in Fox Valley and southeast Wisconsin. So those who say regions of the state, it's not my argument, but them, could reopen a lot quicker than some of these other areas. Right, JR?
Yeah, and the WMC proposal, it factors in basically your population density, i.e. if you're a more rural county someplace that has fewer cases. The argument has been, why should you treat, let's pick, I don't know, Vilas County the same way you do Milwaukee County? You know, much different environment, much different population density. The flip side argument has been from the Evers folks and others and healthcare officials that if you have an outbreak in a rural community, it would overwhelm these small rural hospitals in a way that wouldn't necessarily happen in a Dane County or Milwaukee County. So they've been going back and forth on that, but there is building pressure from Republicans and the business community to do something. The question is, will the governor kind of mold to that, or is he going to stick with this three-phase plan that he has in place right now?
And one thing I found interesting in my in Wisconsin, I interviewed with Kurt Bauer. I asked him about the manufacturing workplace of the future, and could workers have to have their temperature taken, and could they be forced to wear protective gear? Could they be, anyway, the workplace of the future is going to change, but that's just a PS. Okay, JR, next topic. Supreme Court also heard challenges to the partial vetoes that you and I as veteran Capitol reporters have been dealing, that governors have exercised for decades. It's very intriguing. I want to let's just summarize the partial vetoes from made by Governor Evers, four of them, and then two from Scott Walker before I get your reaction. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty challenges Governor Evers' partial vetoes that redirected $10 million from replacing school buses to funding electric vehicle charging stations. And let me get my notes in order here. Allowed funds for local roads to be used for broader purposes. Changed truck registration fees approved by the legislature. Changed the state's authority to regulate e-cigarettes. And I find this intriguing because part of this challenge is not against Governor Evers' partials, but against former Governor Walker's vetoes that was filed by Wisconsin Small Businesses United that challenged Governor Walker moving some dates, specifically changed from 2018 to 2018, the authority for school districts to tax for energy efficiencies, changes, upgrades, and delayed from 2018 to 2078, the moratorium on when retailers can take tax deductions for certain bad debts. Why is this challenge phrased in a way that includes both Evers and Walker partials?
There are two different lawsuits, but get at the same power. And there are different foundations for these lawsuits. In the one from Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, the argument is that Governor Evers uses veto pen to create new law that lawmakers didn't have a chance to review, other than trying to override the veto, right?
Yeah.
The second one says essentially that the governor, Governor Walker, uses veto pen to strike out individual letters, or sorry, numbers, to create new dates, and that hasn't been approved by the courts. Now, don't forget the Vanna White veto that Tommy Thompson used famously back in the 90s or 80s. That was overturned by a constitutional amendment in 1990, I think it was, right? 1990-ish. So that one said you can't strike out individual letters anymore, all right?
Right.
The argument in this suit says, well, it follows if you can't strike out letters, you shouldn't be able to strike out individual numbers. Now, we also know from the 2008 Frankenstein veto amendment, you can no longer stitch together two different sentences and to create a new one. So these powers have been kind of reined in by via constitutional amendment the last 20 years. Now we're going to watch the Supreme Court say, okay, we're going to go a step further and pull it back even more. Now, a couple of things. These arguments take all kinds of tangents. You know, all kinds of issues have come up. But one thing that kind of came up in the oral arguments this week was, did the voters of Wisconsin in 1990 and 2008, by banning the Vanna White veto, by banning the Frankenstein veto, did they embrace this more expansive view of the governor's veto power to include creating new law, basically, to strike out numbers? I mean, what extent did they kind of sign off on this? That was one of the arguments we heard in court on Monday.
And the court also made history by having its first virtual oral argument. Well, I just find intriguing, and the graphic that we used showed that kind of, for want of a better term, the Brady Bunch, the seven justices and the three attorneys arguing before it. So history was made here, both by a special extraordinary session, virtual, last week in with the Assembly and Senate, and now in the Supreme Court. Okay, JR, two topics quickly. Vice President Pence came back to Madison for the first time since January 18, and let's hear him talk about praise for the GE workers making ventilators. Please.
We're going to continue to use the full weight of the federal government and the Defense Production Act to make sure that you have the supplies to continue to scale and increase production. It is truly remarkable what you've accomplished here. It is a testament to a great company. It's a testament to a great workforce. We have one mission, and that's to save lives. We will someday soon put the coronavirus in the past and put all of America back to work.
Quickly, JR, what's the message when Vice President Pence comes to liberal Madison for the second time in about 10 weeks?
That Wisconsin's important, and it's a chance. I mean, don't forget, President Trump loves to be up the campaign trail, loves doing rallies. He can't do those big rallies right now. These are a way for somebody from the administration to get out into the nation, outside the Washington, D.C. bubble, connect with people, generate some positive local headlines, and have a presence in key states that are going to be important this fall.
Well, yeah, and Pence also hit the buttons of manufacturing. Wisconsin and Indiana are the top manufacturing states. Healthcare and ventilators. And just for the record, when the vice president came to Madison on January 28th, he plugged private school vouchers. Okay.
Talking about ventilators is that the poll numbers on the Trump administration initial response to COVID-19 hasn't been that great, you know, and they're kind of trending downwards. They're trying to kind of pump those numbers back up because this issue is so dominating the presidential race right now. If they look bad on this issue, it's not great for them come fall.
Okay. Now, JR, I want to close. Last topic, since there's no stock picks today. Last topic, let's look at Earth Day. And it was started by Democratic Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin in 1970. So here's a clip that we found from the Wayback Machine. Senator Nelson talking about Earth Day, why it's needed in 1970. Then fast forward, the first African-American Lieutenant Governor, Mandela Barnes. He's a member of the Climate Change Task Force. State Representative Mike Kuglich. So just the 50-year look at Earth Day, please.
We elect an ecology Congress as the 92nd Congress, a Congress that will build bridges between our citizens and between men and nature's systems instead of building more highways and dams and new weapon systems that escalate the arms race. Environment is all of America and its problems. It's the rats in the ghetto. It's a hungry child in a land of affluence. It is housing that's not worthy of the name and neighborhoods not fit to inhabit. Environment is a problem perpetuated by expenditures of tens of billions of dollars a year on the Vietnam War instead of on our decaying, crowded, congested, polluted urban areas that are inhuman traps for millions of people.
The next 50 years of Earth Day are not promised, as this pandemic has showed, as it has highlighted. If we continue to disregard our environment, if we ignore the science reality of climate change, if we continue the terrible trend of pollution of our water and air, we may not even have another 50 years before these natural resources before they cease to exist. We should look towards the future and think about how we can continue on this trend, and we will be in a position that is envious of, that is the envy of other states in this country.
As the energy chair over the last 7 years, I noticed a big change, and probably the biggest change is the growth in renewable energy, and more specifically, solar and wind. In the next couple of years, there's going to be almost 10 times the amount of solar and wind in the state of Wisconsin than there is today. So when you couple that with what we're celebrating tomorrow, as far as the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, I would think the people that support Earth Day and support environmentalism would look at that as a positive trend in Wisconsin.
We've only got about a minute left, JR, so let's cover three things quickly. With Senate Democratic Leader Jennifer Schilling stepping down from leadership, although she'll finish out her term, who did the Senate Democrats just elect as their leaders?
Janet Buley, a Mason up in northern Wisconsin by Ashland. She was elected a new minority leader. Janice Ringhan of Evansville is a new assistant minority leader. Buley had been in that number two spot since 2017. Look, it was a little bit of a surprise when Jennifer Shilley announced she wasn't seeking re-election. If you think about it, the fact that she's not coming back next year or not committed to this election in terms of her own prospects, it somewhat makes sense for her not to be leading the effort of Senate Democrats in general, because her interest kind of ends, right, after this fall.
Yep.
So it's just kind of an awkward situation if somebody's not there running it, much like Scott Fitzgerald will be in the Senate Republican caucus. He's got his eye on a congressional seat, right? So he's kind of got one foot in both worlds.
Yeah.
This kind of avoids that. And with Senate Republicans, they've got more input from their team into what's going on. So it's not just Fitzgerald running the show. And this is the same thing here. Jennifer Shilley's not going to be here after this fall. Move a different leader to more invest in what's going on.
Okay, just two other things quickly. Democratic Representative Jason Fields of Milwaukee announced that he will also not be seeking re-election. And just on April 7th, he lost a bid to be Milwaukee City Comptroller. Finally, JR, Foxconn is making something in Wisconsin. Ta-da, that's a first. Personal protective equipment. I don't think, however, that qualifies for those state tax breaks. Do you, JR?
No, we're still waiting for that determination from the Evers administration on what Foxconn might get, if anything, from the state.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm JR Roth.
That's Rewind for April 24.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.